Thank you very much, Brian. That was a great introduction to what's going to be a great day. So we're moving into the first session now, which is tagging turtles and sharks. So we've got three presentations. Firstly, a person who needs no introduction, Dr.
Sorry.
Well, maybe he does.
You can now.
Matt Vandercliff.
Gosh, that's a fucking horrible bloody...
AKA Darth Vader, but yeah.
Try that, Matt.
So Matt's going to talk to us today about From Satellites to Cells, Ecology of Green Turtles of Ningaloo. You ready to go there, Matt?
All right. I might even put my presentation up. Or I could...
Someone else to do that
for me? Well, that would be good. Joe's going to give me a hand. That's good. Thanks, Andy. And I guess while we're getting the presentation up, my starting point, and this wasn't planned, but my starting point follows on quite neatly from Brian's endpoint. And Brian spoke about, you know, going above and beyond what's really needed to be done to try and add value to the region. And our starting point really is with things like this. So we have Ningaloo and all of those biodiversity assets from Ningaloo, and we have plans in what we're going to do with them. So Ningaloo is a World Heritage Area. It's a marine park. In fact, it's a marine park because it's state and Commonwealth. They have plans, but it also has a whole bunch of these valued taxa, valued biological assets, things like turtles that also have plans. So turtles are a listed species and they have recovery plans. So what we're setting out to do is saying, well, where can we come in? And where are those knowledge gaps? Where are the plans setting out objectives, but perhaps are a little bit limited by some of the data? And how can we come in and fill in some of those data gaps to help meet some of the objectives? So, for example, a really simple one is because if we need to know about the status or the trend of a population, we need to start by saying how many there are, which is a really difficult question. And so on, in terms of population demographics, in terms of understanding key areas, key habitats for these things. So those are our starting points. And we think about it in a few different ways. So for example, how many there are? Well, it's an easy question to ask, but as I've stood up here before and I've said, it's a really difficult one to answer because you can't count them all. This is not a complete bit of work. This is just to show one of the ways that we're now starting to think about it. So these, can you see the red dots? So this is basically drone survey. So each of those red dots indicates where the drone has picked up a turtle. So it's a bit incomplete, so you'll see the lines of red dots. That's where the drone's flown over and Nick's analysed the image and he's marked each of the images in which the turtle's been seen. So there's a little bit of overlap. So for example, there's a few dots in a line here, it's the same turtle, but that's just to show the sorts of things that we're going to start to be able to do, all the things that we can see by using drone surveys and being able to map the turtles. So from there, that's right, setting the baseline. These are the ones that we can see on the surface, so we have to be able to use what we know about turtle biology and figure out what's the proportion that we can see that versus the proportion that we can't see, and then extrapolate that out. So there's a bit of work involved. Moving on to movement. So sometimes I stand up here and I talk about the SAT tagging, and I kind of assume a base level of knowledge, and I thought, well, today I might just start by pointing out we use a range of different technologies and a range of different platforms to answer these questions, one of which is this site. Basically, it's satellite. So it's not particularly new technology, but we use it in different ways. So we use especially Argos, basically a French satellite system, as well as something called Fastlop GPS. And what we're doing, if we've got, say, here in the green area, is the Ningaloo World Heritage Area. Say we want to understand what turtles are doing, well, we're going to go and catch them. So there's a region there, and then we pop the satellite tag on them. And then basically sit back and wait for all that data to come in. And we structure our the way we tag the turtles in different ways to answer different questions. So, for example, if we want to know about resident turtles, so turtles have complex life histories, and you know, when they hatch, they go out in the ocean and they come back, and then they stay, and then a proportion will go and nest. Or here's just our resident turtles. So these are the ones that it's not nesting season, or these are not nesters, for example, they're adult males. All those squiggly yellow lines are all of the Argos data for 16 turtles over 4 years now. And what you can see there is pretty much they don't move very much at all. There's one that wandered out into Exmouth Gulf for a while, but mostly they don't leave the World Heritage Area at all, but also they don't tend to move very far. And so when I was playing with this diver on the weekend, and I started saying, well, how far do they move? And one very simple metric for that is just displacement. So this is just the calculation of the distance between where we caught them versus the last location, the last robust location, reliable location that we got from the Argos satellite images. And so what you can see there is something a little bit interesting. And initially I looked at that and I went, well, most of them don't move very far, but then some of them do. And then when I have a look at it even more closely, this is what falls out. So we had two locations that we were working in, one in which we did a lot of work, and then another one which we did a little bit of work. So in Mangrove Bay, when we tag a turtle, it stays there. It doesn't go very far at all. Typically, the distance across Mangrove Bay is maybe 4 or 5 kilometres. And in Mangrove Bay, the total displacement between where we catch them and where they end up over what could be 6 months, could be more than a year, I guess is just over 400 days, was almost always less than 5 kilometres there, and it's very rare that it'll go more than 5 kilometres. Most of them are 1 or 2 kilometres. But if we go down to Sandy Bay, and having a chat to Rich this morning, I'm just thinking, well, Sandy Bay is just a bit different. The habitat's a bit different. Maybe they have to move around a bit more to get the same amount of food. I mean, why, we don't know, but the punchline is that if we go and do exactly the same thing to exactly the same size range, exactly the same sex of turtles in Sandy Bay, they're going to be moving in the tens of kilometres, up to 30 kilometres down to Yardi Creek and back, whereas in Mangrove Bay they don't. So that's our resident turtles punchline. They don't move very much, and mostly they stay inside the military area. What about our nesting turtles? I've talked about complex life histories. So female turtles, I'm talking about green turtles here, I should mention. Female green turtles leave their foraging areas and go and nest on appropriate beaches. We know that there's a whole bunch of appropriate beaches at Ningaloo. And so one of the questions that we were trying to ask initially is, well, we've got some great foraging habitat at Ningaloo, lots of foraging turtles that live at Ningaloo. What about the ones that nest? There's a whole bunch of beaches on the top end of Ningaloo, and maybe Danny's going to talk about that a little bit later on today. Well, there's lots of things, there's some really good data on numbers of nesting turtles. Well, that's what happens if we go to the beach, and this is over 4 years, a lot of long nights. There was a few sunrises that we saw carrying the gear back to the car, or sometimes just sitting on an alley bin falling asleep waiting for that turtle to finish its nest as the sun's rising. The punchline's down the bottom there. Of the 13 turtles that we put sat tags on over those 4 years, 10 of them left the World Heritage Area. So a little bit surprising, we thought, well, great foraging areas in Ningaloo. There's lots of nesting in Ningaloo, perhaps they're not having to move too far, well, most of them do. But then it got even more interesting, and this twigged for me last week in a conversation with Tony Tucker, where I was looking at this year's data, and I thought, well, that's a bit different from what I remember. So I went and had a look. Well, first of all, there's our distance. So, for example, if we go to that question, and it's in the recovery plan for marine turtles, we need to know what the foraging areas are. Well, all of the northwest coast just about is foraging area for a marine turtle. So if we're taking a nesting beach, say So the nesting beaches at North West Cape, and we're saying where are the key foraging areas, well, they're kind of dispersed, but we can build a pretty big model that looks like a log distribution, essentially. So there's a bunch that move 100, 200, 300 kilometres away, and then there's a lower number, that move over 1,000 kilometres. But back to what's been happening over the years. So our first year, tagged 4 turtles, this is what we got. They all moved, but not more than, say, 200 kilometres. In the next 2 years, we tagged another 6 or 7 turtles, and pretty much all of them moved north and west, except for this one that moved south. So first year, not too much. The next 2 years, all moving quite far, and all north and west. This is this year. And Tony's guide will show the same thing, I think. They're all moving south, and one of them's gone down inside the Gulf, and the other three have gone down almost all the way to Shark Bay. Two of them have stopped just south of Hobart, and one of them is now just at that top end of Shark Bay, and it's stayed there. So the punchline is for the nesting turtles, well, they distribute far and wide. They're going outside the World Heritage Area, but there's kind of a hint coming out that changes from year to year. What that means, you don't know yet. We're just kind of starting looking at that. So resident turtles, nesting turtles, then there's the bit in between. Of the resident turtles, we know that some of them are females. Where are they going to nest? So that was a trickier question to answer, and so that's where we went to a different set of technology. Technology that you'll all be aware of, and some of you, no doubt, will have experienced. Bit of ultrasound, so we've got, so it's all, not like back in the day where it's a big machine in a white room. We can pack it in a pally case and take it on the beach with us now, and so we can use the ultrasound, and when we find what we're looking for, it looks a little bit like this. And so we're able to detect the females before they go on their nesting migration. It's not necessarily easy, so this year, 21 turtles, 21 large female turtles, all over 100 kilos, and we found two. But I want to tell you a story about one of them. We tagged it on the 10th of October. So we did the ultrasound, found the eggs, they're only 2.5 centimetres across, 24, 25 millimetres. And then for the first week, it stayed around about Mangrove Bay where we found it, where we tagged it. And then the week following that, it did a runner. And it went up to the Montebello Islands. And you can see there the sparse points. It was just gone. It wasn't stopping. You know, it went to breathe. It didn't stay very long on the surface. It was just going. And then for the next 3.5 months, it stayed there on Montebello Islands. And if we zoom in, it looks like this. So you'll see that there's a whole bunch of little points, all of different colours. These ones here, these green points, are where it spent the first month. So there's no nesting in that first month, so what it was doing is, we think, it's mating. So when we ultrasound it, there's no shell on the egg, it's very small. And so it's got to go, it's going to spend the next month, those eggs are developing, and then they're developing shells. And then after that month spent there, then you can see over the next 2.5 months, it's then spending different amounts of time in different parts of the island, and then you can see in different, right, we've got nesting places. So this was really exciting to us, where we're able to find a turtle in Mangrove Bay, locate this one's going to nest, follow it to where it nests, and now we actually can follow the entire nesting history of one turtle. We've got that 3 times now. So this is just one to show. Oh, this is just to remind me. So this spot here, that shadow that you can see there, is the 1956 bomb test. So if you go onto Te Nui Island now, there's a sign that says don't stay too long, it's radioactive, right? So this explosion here happened there. after 3.5 months, our turtle was positively glowing and on her way back. And if you remember the plot that I showed before, lots of sparse point, right, now it's following exactly the same track back, almost exactly, but look at the density points, that's one tired turtle, it's stopping, it's anyways, so that was really exciting for us. It's the first time that we've closed the loop. A resident turtle to a nesting ground, back to a resident turtle. So that was 30th of January, and then on Friday, live's latest data, still here. All right, how am I going for time? I know Richard won't mind if I take up half of his time. I will try and leave in 5 minutes. So, movement. So we've got resident turtles, we've got nesting turtles, and we've got now closing the loop from resident to nesting. All right, let's start drilling in and thinking a bit more about, well, when they're resident, what are they doing, and how does that help us to think about the habitat? So here is the high-resolution GPS data from one turtle over the space of 8 months. And you can see how it's distributed. There's clusters of points, right? It's spending amounts of time in these different places. So think about that landscape that you've just seen as a buffet. And what we're looking at, scattered through that landscape, are all the goodies that the turtles like to eat, all the different types of plants that we know the turtles like to eat. So what we want to do now is to start thinking about, well, what among those options, what is each turtle doing, and what can we learn about key food sources, key habitats, and then how that helps us to think in the future. For example, you know, heat wave came into Shark Bay a few years ago, killed a whole bunch of seagrass. Important food source for the turtles. So what else might be there that they can rely on? So one way I do that is by looking at isotopes. Going to go into the isotope chemistry today. Think of it as a proxy for diet. So plants capture carbon, they kind of use it in different ways, which stretches them out. Plants suck up nitrogen from the air, they use it in different ways, and that gives us a bit of a map on how plants use carbon and nitrogen, and because they do it in different ways, we can then use those isotopes to try and to piece them apart. And so if I do that for, say, carbon and nitrogen, I get 4 distinct clusters. So I get mangroves, I get seagrasses, and I get basically two different types of red algae based on their carbon physiology. I can do it for sulfur as well because of the way they use salt. But more interesting is, well, what does that mean for the turtles? So here's our turtles. I like to use red blood cells, but there's different other tissues that we can use. And this becomes interesting. So not all turtles are the same. If those numbers mean that's a lot of variation. If we go and sample 100 turtles, which we did here, and we map them against the whole diet landscape, we see that they pretty much encompass the whole landscape, including, if we look at nitrogen, that's the sort of difference that you'd expect between entire trophic levels. Think grasshopper to lions. So what I wanted to do is think about, well, what does that mean? I'll skip through this thing. What does that mean in terms of understanding what drives that variation? And so I looked at size, just how big is the turtle, and of course size is a bit of a proxy for age. And it turns out that size was a really good descriptor for the patterns we see in the isotope data. So the size was a really good descriptor of this kind of proxy for diet. And that wiggly line is just it's what we call the generalized additive model. Just means that there's a mathematical relationship that we can explain. So if we take carbon, there's a wiggly line that goes up and across and down, and essentially the same thing for nitrogen, down, across, and up. So if we take, let's say we take nitrogen, nitrogen's a really nice strong fit, and we start looking at that, all right, look at the size. Small turtles, these are down that high 30s to 50 centimetres, about that. So this is after they've come in from the ocean, and they're coming into the Coast, as the little ones, they're not babies anymore, they're juveniles, and they're changing their diet from whatever they're eating out in the ocean, adapting to what they've got in the coast, seagrass, seaweed, whatever it is. And then as they're growing, again, getting from 50 centimetres up to the ones that are nesting size, so we're getting up to this big now, gradually they're changing in their nitrogen. So there's possible explanations for that. One is that just their physiology changes. Could be explained by physiology or their diet changes. So going back to our diet landscape, thinking about, well, what can we learn from that? Well, it turns out that this pattern here actually matches the pattern we expect from something that would be inshore, feeding on seagrass, where we do see lots and lots of ones, to moving offshore, eating more of this stuff, more of the seaweed, plus augmented with snacking on jellyfish. And it turns out that probably these large turtles are feeding on jellyfish. If you remember the plot that I showed with all the yellow points, every now and then one leaves the lagoon and goes outside. What it's doing out there, we don't know for sure, but one idea we've got is that it goes out to snack on jellyfish. Brian talked about the community engagement that we've done, and you know, one of the real joys that we've got is bringing the school in along with and bringing community along with what we're doing. I'm going to embarrass Zoe and Ashley by saying, you know, having the work experience, come and join us for what we're doing, and having them come back and at the end of the project and hear what we're doing. But I prefer to let them tell you those stories, but I did want to tell you one last story before I stop. And one, that is kind of the unanticipated benefit. So in October, we were catching and tagging the turtles, and it just so happens that we had the wonderful Jane, the ex-mouth vet, and there was a turtle with something sticking out of its eye, a little white piece sticking out of its eye, and on closer inspection, it turned out to be a piece of cod. And despite her very best efforts, Jane couldn't get the piece of cod out of the eye. And so she took it and had a look under surgery, there it is there, took it out and spent the next, Jane, 3 months in rehab, being very well looked after, putting on weight. And then when we were there in January, it was healthy. I had a look at that turtle, I could not remember which eye it had the coral in, and I could look at the turtle, I couldn't tell. It healed up really, really well. And then it was time for release, so Jane kindly said, do you want to come along and watch the release? I said, yeah, we'd love to come and watch the release. We turn up at the beach, and there's 100 people there. So this photo is actually from the Pilgrim Post. It made the news. So one of the unanticipated benefits is the contribution to the turtle rehabilitation, but then the community response was really just overwhelming. Far, far bigger than we had anticipated. So I'm going to stop, move to my punchlines. So what have we learnt after doing this, tagging a lot of turtles, taking a lot of samples? Well, our resident green turtles do have restricted movement and do largely stay in the World Heritage Area. But we are getting some clues that their patterns do vary among the foraging grounds. Mangrove Bay, my movement is different from Sandy Bay movement. Nesting turtles, well, pretty much they're leaving the World Heritage Area, and they're spreading out everywhere from Shark Bay to the Kimberley. But also we're getting a clue that actually changes from year to year. What we found in 2016, 17, 18, 19 changed. Closing the loop, we've managed to identify three incipient turtles. We've got those M follicles on an ultrasound, and we followed them all. They're all left in the loop. Barrow Island, Montebello's, and Amolich. And then the diet changes with size, and it does that in a way that's quite predictable and makes sense to us. So it's consistent with movement into different habitats, from the little ones that are really shallow water to the big ones moving out to the lagoon and feeding on different stuff. So that is it for me. And all that remains is for me to say this is a team effort and can't be done without by far more people than I can list on this slide, but at least that's a starting point. Did I leave the children up on?